Aye.
Clark?
Aye.
Edmondson?
Yes.
Struggle.
Johnson?
Aye.
Mannix? Miller? Bell?
Aye.
Chair Baum?
Votes yes. Senate Bill 572, having received the appropriate majority of support to the full committee, do pass recommendation. Go ahead and close the public hearing. And we'll ask Representative Johnson to carry that bill. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Go ahead and close the public hearing, work session, House Senate Bill 572, and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 426, revises non-corporation profit law for trade schools.
Bad joke, Mr. Chair.
Oh, staff, you want to briefly get into this one? And then we'll have the, we have a list of, we have three sheets of witnesses.
Oh, God.
Oh.
Would you like me to?
We'll bring out Mr. Wolfstein to come on up here and sit while you explain. And we bring anybody else, you're welcome to. Anybody else wants to come up and sit down there? They've got three chairs.
Well, we've seen this before, haven't we?
We have.
I have seen this before, and learned, and most
Why?
Expert counsel will go ahead and bring us up to speed, so you know where you are today.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 426 was before the committee once before. It makes revision to the Nonprofit Corporation Act that was passed during the last session. When the bill was last before the committee, there was no proponent to explain the one provision that provided the stumbling block to passing it out the last time, which was the provision of loans to directors and officers as part of a recruitment package. You have in your materials a section-by-section analysis of the bill, as well as a proposed housekeeping amendment. But Representative Clark wanted to discuss with the proponents of the bill the need for the recruitment package, and that's why the bill is back.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chair, it's just been a while since we've seen this bill.
So that comes shelley forth a little bit.
Yeah, I guess I just...
Why don't you
said,
go
my
ahead.
Recollection was that Council, my recollection was that the committee was kind of comfortable with most of the parts of the bill except the loan. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, that's correct.
So where's the explanation for that then here in the materials?
Right in front of you.
Oh, human explanation. Okay.
Mr. is it Wolfstein?
Mr. Chair, my name is Carl Myers. I'm a Salem attorney. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon State Bar, and my sole purpose in being here is to introduce to you the two gentlemen that are sitting with me at the table. Who can answer the questions of the committee specifically in regards to the loans and the recruitment section. Mr. Jeff Wolfstone is a member of the business law section of the Oregon State Bar and has been following this measure for some time, and Mr. Ross Laybourne of the Department of Justice, chief attorney in the charitable activities section of the Department of Justice, both of whom are knowledgeable in on this bill and can answer your questions.
For the record, Jeff Wolfstone, I'm a lawyer in private practice in Portland. Been before this committee in the last session when the initial legislation that now makes up ORS Chapter 65 was proposed. And what we're doing, obviously, is coming back with some technical corrections and dealing with the items that have come out of the a little short of two years of experience under the Act. The on the plus side, and this is just by way of broad background, the experience has been pretty good. The feedback we've gotten quite a bit has been positive. We solicited comments from members of the nonprofit community and from the bar, and we received some, and we've tried to address them here. The one that's particularly of interest, as I understand it at this point, is ORS 65.364. By way of background on that particular section, little bit of history maybe is helpful. Prior to 1989 and for a number of years, the Oregon statute, which was in Chapter 61, was based upon the prior Model Act, Model Acts being put together by the American Bar Association with a lot of input over a substantial period of time, many of the states then take those model acts and adopt them, tinker with them, and those become law. In that prior section, prior to 1989, loans to officers and directors were not allowed. And I guess starting with that, the question really is, what's the policy behind this this prohibition that that exists or existed? The commentary on the subject, and there isn't a great deal of it, is that it really goes to the point that nonprofit corporations are there to serve a quasi-public purpose, if you will, and that it should not be allowed as a vehicle for private benefit, put it kind of in a nutshell. The new Model Act, on which ORS 65.364 carried forward that same approach, not allowing, in the case of what are called public benefit and religious corporations, which are two of the three categories of nonprofits. We took a different approach in this state following from the Model Act, where we looked at dividing them into categories, recognizing that many of them do substantially different things. In the case of public benefit and religious corporations, it was felt in the legislation brought forward in 1989 that we should continue the policy of not allowing loans or guarantees to officers and directors of public benefit and religious corporations. We received a lot of comment on that, and so then we started to sit down and really take a close look at the policy. What's really at stake here? And we discovered through our discussions in the task force, which is composed of about 13 lawyers as well as representatives of the Secretary of State Corporation Division, to take a look at why. And when we started digging into that, we discovered that many nonprofits have, over the years, found it very tough to recruit good people to run their organizations. And what kinds of organizations are we talking about? There's a pretty broad scope. A number of them are in this category of public benefit and religious. We're talking about colleges, private colleges, hospitals, other healthcare providers that are organized as nonprofits, museums, churches, other action-type organizations such as the ACLU, charities in the sense that we might think of them like the United Way, foundations, and a number of other types of organizations that provide services for the public. And the reason they are having trouble recruiting is that in many cases they end up competing for talent with the public sector or with private business. And so we started to say, okay, well, what do they, what problems do they run into? Well, oftentimes to attract, and this may be true more for the larger organizations than the smaller ones, although I don't have a study in front of me that shows this, they would oftentimes be trying to recruit somebody either to this state or from within this state, and competing for people who might need assistance in the way of a guarantee of a home loan or other, another kind of package that would allow them to make it financially feasible to take on the position. And so what we've attempted to do in this proposed change is to say, okay, we recognize that, and there have been specific instances where this has come up as an issue, and these are often the most highly placed people who would be looked at for officer positions or director positions, or oftentimes people who would serve in both positions once recruited. And the ability to offer such a package is often a key criterion in somebody's decision-making process. So what we tried to do is to say, okay, from there, if we're going to consider allowing it, what protections should be put in here? How do we balance the policy concerns that existed and continue to exist about the public, quasi-public, however you want to put it, nature of these organizations versus the concern about allowing private benefits to occur. And so what we said was that in the context of a recruitment package, the allowance of a loan or a guarantee could be provided for a period not to exceed 3 years, so we're trying to get at front-end type situations, where the approval, number one, comes through a process that is provided in the statute in another section dealing with conflicts of interest, which requires full disclosure of the potential conflict between the director or officer's interests and the interests of the corporation, coupled with a vote by a disinterested majority supporting it. Secondly, we provided that notice of that loan guarantee or other provision be given to the members of the corporation as provided in another section of the statute. And then finally, that there be at least 20 days notice before the loan or guarantee is made and or to become binding to the Attorney General of the package, including the identification of the amount and character of all items and a separate statement of the amount and terms of the loan guarantee or modification. And I'd like to raise just one technical item here, and this is probably directed at counsel. There is a typographical error in line 33, at least of my printed copy. I hope it corresponds to yours, where the word indemnification should be identification. I hope that hasn't caused any confusion here. So what we've tried to do is to build in some safeguards to balance those interests. That's what this proposal is intended to do.
Representative Clark.
I guess I'm still not convinced about the underlying policy decision that the committee is advocating, not this committee, the bar committee. I supported the nonprofit revision last time. I think I carried it on the floor, if I recall correctly. Very supportive of the work of nonprofit organizations. I guess I don't agree that the reason we have trouble getting people to serve on nonprofits is because of competition with the private sector, with for-profit businesses.
And just a footnote there is that oftentimes some of these organizations are competing nationally, and other states allow these recruitment packages. And if it comes down to a close choice, it can be a deciding factor. And if you're going to attract a college president or a hospital administrator with substantial national pull, that can become an issue.
Let me ask, is there a policy distinction, and I might be able to open a door in my own mind, is there a policy distinction between a director and an officer? I mean, if I'm asked to serve on the board of St. Vincent Hospital, should I really have the ability to try and negotiate the underwriting of a personal loan by the hospital as a reason for me to serve on the board of the hospital? If, on the other hand, I'm coming in as an officer and as part of an overall compensation package, the hospital wants to do that. That one makes more sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
From the standpoint of an officer. I don't know what you do when you get an officer and a director is in the same person. I don't know what you do with that. But setting that aside for a minute, might there be a policy distinction between an officer and a director? Because the work of a director, it seems to me, at least in a nonprofit context, an officer theoretically is at least I think in the common situation, the officer is going to be compensated somehow for work performed. The director may or may not be, at least in my experience, may or may not be compensated.
In my experience, typically no. Typically they receive reimbursement sometimes of expenses, out of pocket, etc.
You serve on more high-powered nonprofit boards than I do because I don't even get reimbursement. But that's what I'm struggling with is maybe the distinction between an officer and a director. Then the other question, Mr. Chair, aside from that policy question, if I can keep going for just a second, The question of the notice to the Attorney General of the loan. Can you remind me of what the statute now says in terms of what the Attorney General can do? I remember last session that the Attorney General got a little bit more authority to regulate the new kinds of classes of nonprofits, but I can't exactly remember what the Attorney General can
and
do.
I'd like to defer to the person who gets these notices and see what he says about it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, I'm Ross Labor, an Assistant Attorney General. In response to your question, Representative Clark, first of all, the Attorney General at common law has authority over charitable organizations. We have some now statutory authority, which includes both the Charitable Trust and Corporation Act and the Charitable Solicitations Act, and now, as you're referring to, there is some specific authority for the Attorney General over some of these subcategories of nonprofit corporations, in particular public benefit corporations. And that authority is kind of weaved all throughout a very extensive Chapter 65, so that in some cases there is authority for the Attorney General to act, to go to court with respect to particular identified abuses. In other cases, there are these kinds of notice provisions, probably 10 or 15 subparagraphs throughout the Act, where a certain type of transaction require, you know, when a public benefit organization is going to enter into that, requires notice in advance to the Attorney General.
Okay, and I guess what I'm fishing for is, what does the Attorney General, what happens in your office when you get a notice that the Good Society nonprofit corporation has decided to merge with somebody else or decided to sell property or whatever? What do you do with that notice in the worst case scenario? You go to court and say this is violates the statute somehow.
Again, what we're looking for when we look at that notice or that transaction is, do we detect what we would consider to be either a specific violation of the Act or something that would constitute, in more general terms, a breach of fiduciary duty? So, for instance, if this were to pass in its present form, when we receive that notice, one of the things that we would look at would be the totality of circumstances that were involved in entering into that loan with the officer or director. Also, of course, the terms. For instance, if you had a loan on its face, let's say for no interest, I think we would look at that and say, well, that doesn't look like an arm's length transaction, and we don't understand why the corporation entered into or proposes to enter into it. What I would think is, the way this is tied in with the other provision regarding conflicts of interest, that one would expect this to be at least an arm's length transaction.
Okay, well, I guess I appreciate your answer, but I'm not sure it makes me any more comfortable, and here's why. If we're giving nonprofits the authority, aren't we just inviting abuse? I guess is what I'm asking. Aren't we just inviting abuse? The St. Andrew Legal Clinic, I serve on the board, used to serve on their board, they want me to come back on the board, let's say, and they agree to underwrite all of my business debt. First of all, they can't do it. They don't have the ability, the financial ability to do that. But let's say they did. My bank doesn't have the ability to do that. But let's say that they did.
There's your friends out.
And you get notice of that. You're going to act on that. You're going to move on that.
I would assume he would seek to enjoin the loan if the parties didn't voluntarily back down.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Brian. I guess following on that, is the AG's office chomping at the bit to get into this area?
Time on your hands, perhaps? Aren't you in it already?
Well, I mean, in terms of evaluating whether or not loans are being made, and you're going to have a degree of diligence in passing on those, so there's some liability there to decide if these are sound and appropriate.
And Mr. Chairman,
they're not going to be liable, are you?
Well, to try and address that, you know, right now, I can tell you historically, obviously, if we learn through one source or another that such a loan exists, it's a real simple test at the moment. It's illegal. And so we have found that to be the case in circumstances in the past. We have gone to the organization, and typically it's the organization acting out of ignorance, and we have said, you have got to unwind this transaction and do it quickly, otherwise we're going to take action. Typically the organization does so. What obviously happens in this particular case is, if this were adopted, then it makes our task a little bit more difficult in that, rather than having a bright line rule which says absolutely this is prohibited, we're required to evaluate the transaction.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, to follow, thank you. Mr. Wolfstone, can you, I don't think you gave an answer to the question on the wisdom of a policy of allowing loans, or perhaps you could give me a couple of examples of, it's hard for me to imagine when a private nonprofit would need to offer loans for directors.
Well, I've been thinking about it as you've been talking, and I do not have in mind a situation that would specifically address a director solely as a director. So in answer to your question, I cannot come up with on the spot a good response to that question. I guess the flip side of it, it may be that it is often the case that someone who is recruited as an officer will also be a director. And so I would not want to have a, I don't think it would be, if we were to change the proposal so that it were to allow for a loan or guarantee to officers, I would think we would start running into problems, because we would then start saying, well, can they be a director as well? I don't know. Obviously, I would imagine the test, if somebody's coming in as a director, if Ross, through his office, were to look at it, would probably be a different, there would be a different smell test, I would imagine.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Bryan, Representative Clark, Representative Mannix.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
The Mannix.
What I've been listening to, I was one of the people who didn't like the loan provision last session. I started to swing over and say, well, what the heck, what difference does it make? But then I've heard these expressions of concern about, and I started thinking about forming the Church of Righteous Indignation and figuring out some sort of a scheme where I am now going to provide loans to myself, which I'll use for various purposes. And granted, the Attorney General would have to be given notice of these and might intervene. On the other hand, I worry, too, about the Attorney General looking at church-type activities and starting to intervene in their activities, which concerns me with the freedom of religion. And I start swaying back and forth, and I say, well, wait a minute. We're starting to sway back and forth on this. Where is the great need for this loan provision as opposed to the rest of this bill? Who has lost a recruitment opportunity for a major officer for a major nonprofit corporation because they couldn't put together a recruitment package that included a loan?
That's a fair question. I don't know that I can cite the examples on the spot, and I'd have to probably get some authority from the parties who have been involved in them to disclose them. But I think in the context of the discussions we've had, maybe I could bring forward some examples. I am aware of some private colleges in the Portland area, for example, where they have, I don't know if they've lost somebody, but I know that it's been a very tough issue that they were unable to compete by offering up a loan to somebody who was going to be the president. And I think that instance in particular is what was probably the strongest push in this direction. It also happens...
Are you talking low-interest home loans and this kind of thing, or...?
It might be either a loan to cover certain expenses involved in relocating to another community, or a guarantee of a home loan or a part of a home loan, or a second loan to help cover, you know, that kind of a move. It does it does come up, and I even outside the context of directors, for example, in certain hospitals recruiting doctors, this is a very common practice.
Why do those doctors have to be officers or directors?
Well, they don't have to be, and I'm just citing that as an example of some of the things that occur with respect to nonprofits at, I'll say, below the officer level. And so there starts to be a question, well, if we can do this for certain other parties, can we also not do it for the officers? If we go through a more rigorous test, namely...
And I'm aware of the rigorous test.
Okay.
Right in front of you. One follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Representative DeCombe.
Oh.
Thank you, Mr. Coppola.
Called Frank.
Frank.
I guess you have a choice today. Maybe there's the votes here to leave in this loan provision, maybe there's not. One choice is to take out the loan provision and get the bill out. Another choice is to have us sit on it while you go out there and try to get some horror story letters to us to convince us that it's worth putting in as a matter of public policy. And my concern is, of course, if that's sort of a choice that has to be made, because the rest of the bill is a piece of cake. With the one correction of indemnification to identification. At least I think it is.
Let me go ahead and open up work session.
Mr. Chairman.
For the public testimony.
Point of order.
Senate Bill 426.
Point of order, just for Representative Mannix's benefit. The Church of Righteous Indignation has already been formed. Call the Oregon Republican Party.
Okay.
It depends.
Well, wait a minute. For the comments out front, you can sit there during the work session. We may ask you questions, but we're going to open a work session on the bill, which is the normal procedure step to then start moving the bill to the full committee.
Okay.
So in case you want to know, if you look at it, like, you kind of want to know what we're about to do.
It's going to be a test.
And it's never painful, but sometimes disappointing. But in any case, we'll move that in the work session so you know what we're doing, and then we'll ask the committee to look at the bill and see what they want to do. Do you have any further comments before we move to work session?
Only that I think that our committee would be willing to entertain a change that would reduce the reference to delete director if that were a way of getting the bill to move forward.
Chair, one other possibility I just spotted. I can't imagine situations where a public benefit corporation might need this ability easier than I can imagine the situation where a religious corporation might need this ability.
I'm sorry, I missed that.
I have an easier time, in theory, with the idea of this authority going for a public benefit corporation than a religious corporation. And I keep thinking about the potential for abuse in my mind, and it keeps coming back to a religious or quasi-religious scenario of a corporation. No, and that's not impugning anybody's. I'm talking about
family lending.
I'm talking about
in terms of the membership of the organization, the kinds of things that. And so I'm wondering, I asked you before, is there a policy distinction between officers and directors? Might there be a policy distinction between public benefits and religious corporations?
Well, I'd have to say we did not have deep consideration of this issue. However, I'll make a couple of points. One, first of all, we have to separate all of these organizations into what I'll call the ones that are not going to get the Attorney General's office attention for more general reasons, and that is the large class, and then we have probably a fringe of organizations that may abuse the entitlements, if you will, of being organized as a nonprofit corporation, and those have to be addressed. There's no question about that. But I think we have to be careful about letting that small group, if we have reasonable ways of addressing those abuses, to write the rules that tie the hands unduly of the large class. And so it's a tough choice at that point. Now, when you look at, and the second point I make, when you look at religious and you compare them with public benefit, we have to be careful and say, well, what is a religious corporation? And there is obviously a detailed definition, but many religious corporations, number one, are not what you necessarily think of as, strictly speaking, a church. They often are doing a number of other things, such as running a hospital or running a school, And so they're often doing very much the same activities, and so it gets hard to draw those lines.
But I also remember, Mr. Chairman, I also remember that Mr. Laybourne, maybe you'll answer this, under the last session's legislation, the Attorney General's ability to regulate a religious corporation is substantially less than the Attorney General's ability to regulate a public benefit corporation, and we kicked that around in terms of is there going to be an incentive for people to file a religious corporation for that reason, and we decided, I think, ultimately that there would not be. How does that figure into this whole thing as well? I'm really muddy in the water.
We want to go into work session, Representative Clark? I just kind of want to float here a little bit.
Doesn't matter to me.
Okay. Let me respond. I think he asked kind of, or somebody did.
I'll address the chair, but with a question that the Attorney General's office might respond to, whether they've seen a perceptible change in that regard since 1989 when this new legislation became effective. Has it become a bigger concern, lesser concern? Hard to tell.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I have, you know, recognizing that up until 1989, we didn't have the three subcategories. So, you know, people didn't have